TV soundtracks. It's the number one place to go. From old world to new. Like a cool breeze coming through. Yes, it's Morricone Island.
You're tuned to Morricone Island and WFMU. I'm your host, Devin Levins, every Tuesday from 8 to 9 p.m. playing the soundtrack hits. This week is no exception. We have special guests joining us. Mike Post, the very prolific television episodic TV series and theme song composer, on his own and at one point with his usual collaborator, Pete Carpenter. Comes from the jazz world. He started as a session musician working with the Wrecking Crew, what's now known as the Wrecking Crew, but back in the 60s on Sonny and Cher records, and at one point became music director for the Andy Williams Show, produced, arranged, conducted, etc. Everything from Mason Williams' Classical Gas in 1968 all the way to the late 90s, producing Van Halen's comeback album, Van Halen 3. He's worked with Kenny Rogers' First Edition in the late 60s and Dolly Parton's 9 to 5 and Odd Jobs back in 1981. He's periodically put out solo records under the name the Mike Post Coalition. One of his tracks appears on various Northern Soul compilations. And he once again has recently composed and recorded and coming out on April 5th on Sony Classical Records, a new solo album, which is a virtual concerto between an orchestra and, in one instance, a bluegrass band, and the other, a blues band. It's entitled Message from the Mountains, Echoes of the Delta. Conceived during the pandemic, during lockdown. Info at mike-post.com, it is website. How are you?
I'm good. I'm Mike.
Nice to meet you.
I know the station. I think I was on there in the 80s, yeah.
Yeah, it's been around since 58.
Pretty cool.
I feel like all composers, the way that they got to where they are, they all have a different story for the most part. It's not just the standard, hi, I went to USC Film Scoring School and I got a gig with John Williams and here I am. It's always a different story, so it's always interesting to me. Yours particularly, I'm a huge, huge fan of the musicians now referred to as the Wrecking Crew.
You know, I swear to you, honest to God, in different interviews or different talks and this and that, people will say, what are you most proud of? Most of the time, there's some guy looking for me to say, well, I like this main title better than that main title or this theme better than that theme. I go, you know, I think maybe what I'm most proud of is the fact that, you know, I've never been sued, I've never been deposed, nobody's ever accused me of ripping them off or lying or cheating. But after that, those 3-4 years where I was part of the Wrecking Crew, that's what I'm most proud of, you know?
Yeah, just a huge honor, and you're just playing with some of the best unheralded musicians on the planet, you know, that ever walked this earth. And to be a part of that has to be insane. How did you get to be a part of them?
You know, I was so lucky because I was here, right? So I was working in clubs since I was 16 as a piano player, but I was a folkie and I was a finger picker. And unlike all the rest of the folkies, you know, I was used to playing with a band, so my time was good. And yet I could finger pick and I had an electric 12 string and I could read, mm-hmm. You know, so I had this buddy of mine named Michelle Rubini at the time, who was working with a bunch of different people, and he and I were really good friends. And he called me up one day. He said, hey, you know that role you do on that finger picking thing you do on your electric? I said, yeah. He goes, I think that'd be really cool if I could copy that on harpsichord. You know, we could do it kind of together. And he said, I'm working with this duet. Why don't you? I think I can get you on this record date next week. Maybe we can do that together, you know. I got you, babe.
Jeez. Yeah, your credit on the Cher record, right?
Sonny and Cher, I got you, babe.
Yeah.
And they liked what I did, and I'm looking around, and there's Don Peek and Barney Kessel and Hal Blaine and, all the guys. And then the next thing I know, I meet Nechtel, and we start, and Osborne and all those guys, and it just blows up. It's just like it happened so fast. And everybody, you know, I mean, I'm getting a lot of calls in there. I'm Tommy Tedesco, and I'm sitting next to him, you know. And it happened so fast, but consistently, and it was good. It was really good, fun, and interesting. And
is it intimidating being that your main instrument is piano and you're playing guitar with all these giants?
No, it wasn't, because what I was being hired for was to play, you know, to play rhythm as a, you know, I had an L5, I had a Tele, I had a Les Paul, I had some really good acoustics, and so I was either going to play, you know, Django, you know, it was either that or chink, you know, or some little line, you know, and then I was going to finger pick. I was sort of that guy, right? Yeah. And this was back in the 4-track days, so there was no, we had to do it live, you know, it was like, let's go. And I was either too young or too dumb or something to be scared. I just wasn't, you know, I'm going, well, I guess I'm supposed to be here, you know?
Yeah.
And then I was too ambitious to last very long, because, you know, for the first 6 months, I was just like, man, this is so much fun. It's so cool. And then I kept going, well, that's not what the strings ought to be doing. That isn't what the bass line ought to be, you know? And I started arranging, you know, and getting gigs as an arranger. And then that led to getting gigs as a producer to protect the stuff I was writing as an arranger. So that's how I became, you know, and then by the time I'm 21, 22, I get hired by Jimmy Bowen to be a record producer. And the next thing you know, the First Edition and then Classical Gas, and I'm off and running, you know.
And Andy Williams Show.
Yep.
Was that right before that?
Yeah. Writing crew stuff happened at 19, 18, 19, 20, 21. The producing stuff at 22 and 23. And then because of Classical Gas, Andy's going back on the air at 8 o'clock. So he needed to have a more contemporary spin on the music. And he said, well, is there a young guy we can hire that is, you know, knows about the orchestra? And he said, well, there's this kid, you know. The 24-year-old, I was 23 at the time of Classical Gas, and it was either me or Jimmy Webb. We were sort of the kind of the guys that first had the idea about orchestrating rock and roll licks, you know, out of the rhythm section. And, you know, all of his friends thought, hey, this guy, Mike Post, ripped you off with this Classical Gas. And all of my friends thought, hey, MacArthur's Park is a complete ripoff of, you know. And when I finally met him, we laughed our asses off, because we were just, you know, I never heard his record before I did my record, and vice versa. And we weren't trying to, you know, mess with anything. We were just had an idea, you know. We were just rock and roll guys that thought it could go into the orchestra pretty well. And we were right.
So after like Kenny Rogers, First Edition and that era, Mason Williams, you had a stab at a TV theme or a TV show that with your friend Pete Carpenter?
Yeah. What happened, the first thing that happened was Andy and his manager, Alan Bernard, asked me, would I be interested in being the music director of the Andy Williams Show? Okay. Now I show up every day with a 45-piece orchestra, whatever it was, every week, and I get a lab. It's a laboratory, you know, I get to try all this stuff. And then, plus I get to work with this carousel of the greatest artists in the world and my idols, you know. I mean, first Andy Williams Show I did, Ray Charles, you know what I mean? It's like, okay, here we go, you know. It's like, hey, you know, I mean, we're Gladys Knight, Aretha, you know, Chuck Berry, Bo Diddley, Jerry Lee, you know, I mean, it's like, man, you know, it's like the James Taylor record, you know, Hey Mister, It's Me Up on the Jukebox, you know. It's like, man, and I'm getting to work with the people I've. Once that happened, I had this good friend, Pete Carpenter, who was a wonderful orchestrator, you know, arranger. And so I asked him to help me on as a, you know, do some of the stuff that I didn't feel I could do as well at as he could on the Andy Williams Show. And so I did the Andy Williams Show for 2 years. And I think maybe just at the end of maybe right after the 2-year run of that, I got a call to do a movie of the week. And I said, well, to be honest with you, I've never scored anything. I don't know how to put music to a picture, but I have a friend that worked with Earl Hagen on all of those half hours, and he knows how to put music to picture. So, you know, I called Pete up and I said, hey, these guys, Lincoln Levinson, want me to do this movie of the week about something, and would you like to do it together as a partnership? And we were already trading information and playing golf together and shooting pool together. We just liked each other, you know. He was older than my father, but we were like brothers, you know, because we were both, you know, crazy musicians and trying to learn new stuff. And, you know, he was sort of more a big band jazz guy and a legit guy. And I was more a rock and roll guy, of course. And but he, when he heard Classical Gas, he liked it and said, you know, I guess I just don't know enough about rock and roll. And would you like to get together and just hang? And I said, hell yes, you know. So he turned me on to a whole bunch of stuff I hadn't heard and vice versa. And when I got the call to do some music for TV, I, you know, I said, well, I ain't doing it without Pete. So Pete said, yeah, let's do it together. So we did.
That went on for a number of years. I mean, and just some of like the biggest episodic, you know, cop shows and whatnot, not just that, but throughout the years, like 70s and 80s.
17 years together.
What was the big one? Rockford Files? Or?
Yeah, that was the first one that lasted, anybody knew. The first one was a Steve Cannell show called Toma. Which was the forerunner of Beretta.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had done two movies of the week together, just, you know, little 90-minute movies, and they were, you know, pretty successful. And Cannell, who I had already become friends with, had always said, if I could ever sell a script and get a producer to listen to me, you know, I think your music would be great. And so, okay. So not only does he sell scripts, you know, he was the story editor on a show called One Adam 12. So then from that, he got this Toma thing. And from that, he did the pilot for Rockford. And that sort of, he drugged me and Pete along with him. And we did all the music that for every show he ever did for forever, you know.
How did like some of these new analog synthesizers come into it? Is that coming from you as the younger guy?
Definitely. Definitely. Yeah. That, you know, when the first Mini Moog came out, you know, I went, oh God, listen to that. That's cool. That might make a kind of a neat thing, you know? And so when we sat down to write a theme for Rockford, we'd never seen any picture. We just read the script, and Cannell told me what was important to him, you know, that it have a little Southernness because of Jim Garner being from Oklahoma and blah, blah, blah. So I thought, okay, man, use harmonica, you know, we had to use blues harmonica, you know. And so we tried, well, what would go with it? All right, guitar. All right, I'm a guitar player. Let's see, this would be funky, you know. And then what's the lead instrument on the A section? You know, I thought, God, I just bought this little Mini Moog here. Pete, do you like the way this sounds? And I'm, you know. And he went, oh, that sounds great. Let's use that, you know. And so we combined that with, you know, see, our horn section was three French horns, three trombones, no trumpets, right? You know, a small string section, a small woodwind section. And the harmonica was actually part of the woodwinds in scoring, you know. So it's kind of all fell together. It was odd ideas, you know. We were, you know, Sam Phillips, Sun Records, you know, his quote is the great one. I'm paraphrasing it, but if you aren't doing something different, you aren't doing much at all, you know.
Yeah.
And so that was the idea, you know, to, if I'm going to be the first rock and roll guy doing television, you know, basically all we did was take the idea of being very tuneful, which was, you know, Mancini had a lock on that, right?
Right.
But he came from a jazz background. Okay, well, we're going to be tuneful. It's going to be theme and variation. We're not going to just make a bunch of music that doesn't kind of go together. We're going to have a whole kind of voice of the music, right? But it's going to be based in the rhythm section and fleshed out in the orchestra, you know. That's all.
What was the division of labor, being that he was primarily a trombonist and you're coming from keyboard guitar? Were you guys jumping instruments? And
here's the greatest thing, buddy. it's so much. I wish he was alive today, because it we'd be sitting here talking to you and you'd be laughing your ass off, because we look like Mutt and Jeff, you know, much older, and, you know, and here I am, you know, at the time, much younger. So all of his friends, after we started making it, and all of his friends are going, oh, no, that Mike Post, he's just a hummer. Pete does all the heavy lifting, you know, he's really the brains. He knows how to, he knows the architecture, right? He knows the engineering. And then all of my friends are going, God, why is Mike working with that old guy? He's, you know, Mike's the guy coming up with all the hit licks and all the, he's making the hit records. God, he doesn't need Pete Carpenter. You know, they were all so entirely wrong, completely wrong. We sat in the same room. He would play piano, I'd write. I'd play piano, he'd write. We just worked together. You know, we never, well, who had the carrots and who had the peas? You know, none of that. We never had a contract. We never had a handshake. We sat in the back of his house and laughed and had so much fun and went out to eat every day and laughed our butts off and played pool when we got bored and, you know, went out and played golf and our wives were friends and we just had a great time together. I don't know what he wrote. I don't know what I wrote. It didn't matter. We were partners. We split everything 50-50. And we never had an unkind word between us. Never had an argument. Never had nothing. We just had a ball. And we wrote stacks of music. And I thought I was stealing. I'm going, this is the greatest gig in the world. This is so much fun. And working for a guy like Cannell, nobody ever kind of messed with us. You know, Cannell was a man of his word and so talented and so fast. And he wrote so much stuff and he had such great ideas. And he kept almost everybody away from us to not mess with us. Don't mess with the music. Let Mike and Pete do it. You know,
how long did that collaboration work?
17 years until he died. You know, 74. Rockford started in 72, I think. So 70s and 80s. Now, Pete took some time off because he had some health problems. So I did Hill Street by myself. But as soon as his health turned around, I said, well, come back and do Hill Street. No, no, that's your deal. You do that. And so then when we rebooted after his heart thing was kind of a drag and he couldn't work. After that, we did Wise Guy and a couple of other shows for Cannell. And then he got cancer, and then it was like, okay, you're on your own, kid. You know, it's like, all right, but if he was alive today, I'd still have a partner. You know, I mean,
and yeah, I must remind the listeners, you know, that not just Rockford Files, but like Law and Order, L.A. Law, NYPD Blue, Magnum PI, Greatest American Hero, one of my all-time favorite shows. Well, also, A-Team, I can't overlook that. But also one of my all-time favorite shows, and embarrassingly, maybe, I played in a concept band in the 90s for the White Shadow, where there was Coach Reeves, and there was that was Goldstein.
You know, I mean, honest to God, that was so much fun with Pete. We just had a ball. I mean, we just had a wonderful time together. And you show me another partnership that's never has an argument, never has an unkind word. You know, we just had a ball together.
Yeah. And so, I mean, because primarily you're known as, and you've worked the majority of your career kind of a behind the scenes supporting role, you know, helping directors, helping producers, helping musicians or record labels if you're arranging or conducting or whatever. But periodically you did put out solo records, right? In 1969, there was Fused, and there's kind of a track from that that keeps popping up on different compilations, Northern Soul compilations. It was Afternoon of the Rhino?
The Rhino.
Yeah.
Yeah. Afternoon of the Rhino, yeah.
So I guess back then, even in 69, were you sometimes looking to kind of do a solo gig or to perform on your own or put a band together and stuff? Or was that just a fun side project because you had some downtime?
Yeah, what really happened on that, and honestly, the album that I'm about to release now is related to Fused. And everything else in between, all the other albums that I put out, were all based upon music that I had done for a TV show, right?
Yeah.
But Fused, honestly, was in answer to the fact that, you know, after Classical Gas, Mason Williams and I had kind of a disagreement and a falling out about which direction things should go. And so when he wasn't successful with this subsequent music that he put out, then Warner's came to me and said, hey, maybe you had more to do with Classical Gas than we thought. Do you consider doing an instrumental album for us? And I thought about it. I thought, well, I'm going to make this like a film demo. I'm going to make this a demo to get more gigs doing film and television, you know? So Pete and I wrote a bunch of it together. I wrote stuff with all the guys in the rhythm section, you know, that I've, you know, Wrecking Crew guys that I'd been working with. And so I put that album out, and that was the last standalone music that I did. All the rest of the stuff was music that was, a you know, kind of associated with TV. And then when COVID hit, what happened was I got this idea that, well, you know, I don't think anybody's ever done a concerto with a five-piece bluegrass band up against an orchestra. So I started writing this thing. And when I was halfway done just sketching and writing by hand the old way, I thought, if this works for a bluegrass band and an orchestra, this will work great for a blues band and an orchestra. So I'll make two pieces and maybe I'll make an album out of it. And that's exactly what this Message from the Mountain Echoes of the Delta record that's coming out right now. That's the continuation of that Fused album that was only an answer to the fact that the record company wanted to try and find another classical gas, you know?
Yeah. And so it is an interesting, and I don't know how many times this has been done, but it's like your fusion of an orchestra with a blues band, your fusion of an orchestra with a bluegrass band. And it's unique. It's funny that there are a lot of cinematic moments throughout. I think maybe by accident or maybe on purpose, like it feels like each second track of each one of those almost feels like an old 70s. It's like it kind of nods to 70s TV shows or action films or whatnot. I think there is definitely the bluegrass in there. You hear it all over, not just instrumentation wise, but the influence and everything. But there still is the cinematic quality, and I guess that's the orchestra and obviously your mind composing it all, writing it all out.
You know, look, you're a smart guy. You're in the band. You already know what the hell I'm doing. So look, it's simple. I just had this weird eclectic background to where I could take these authentic licks out of the rhythm section and put them in the orchestra, because I wasn't, you know, I'm a legitimate bluegrass more than a fan, right? I'm a legitimate guy, you know. I mean, I can tell you the day that I bought the Foggy Mountain Breakdown album, and it was just a seminal part of my life. I can, you know, you and I are amongst the few people that know the difference between BB and Albert and Freddie King. There's three kings, okay? But they all sound different. You know, they're all playing the blues, but it's different. And so at any rate, you know, I think that I'm, you know, one of the right guys to take licks out of a bluegrass rhythm section, set them in the orchestra in a way that the orchestra can play them, and vice versa. You know, how can I put the bluegrass band in the orchestral setting and make it sound like a conversation? That's what I was looking for. Okay, well, most bluegrass players don't read and most orchestral players don't jam. How can I make that happen? You know, so that was the project. That was the idea. How can I make this not sound like I'm sticking something, just pasting something onto another something? You know, how can I make it sound like it's all one band? That's what I tried to accomplish with Message from the Mountains in a bluegrass way. And Echoes of the Delta is just the exact same idea, taking genius bluegrass players or genius blues players and putting them with the orchestra, you know, and vice versa.
You're in L.A. Are you L.A. born and bred? You're not from the Appalachians and you're not from the Delta, obviously.
Okay, so here's the deal. Yeah, here's the deal on me. I was born in Berkeley, California, and I moved down to the Valley. I'm through and through Valley guy. Moved to the San Fernando Valley when I was 6, and I've been here ever since. My mother's from Arkansas, and growing up in, you know, my house, we heard everything from Dvorak to the Grand Canyon Suite to Copland to all the rest of that, and, you know, Mozart and Bach and Beethoven to Ella, to Louis Armstrong, to the Yerba Buena Jazz Band, to all this eclectic stuff. You know, I was just, so much music was available in my house because my folks were really big music fans and they had very eclectic tastes. You know, my first memories are of something to do with music. Either my mom, you know, rocking me to sleep and singing to me, or somebody playing something, or, you know, so it just came out weird that way. You know, I was definitely, you know, a middle-class Jewish kid from the Valley looking for a dusty road to walk down so I could, you know, but the first time I went down south, I went, holy moly, this is perfect. This is it, you know, this is it.
Yeah, I mean, and that's where some of the most interesting music comes from, not necessarily the Beatles and Stones were influenced by American Southern music and blues and whatnot, and that you take your inspiration from where you are, and also the grass always seems greener on the other side. You can, and you learn from, you know, what you don't know when you just try to figure it out on your own. But there's also, you're the grandson or great grandson of Ukrainian immigrant, and there's some influence of that kind of melding its way into this latest release.
Yes, my grandfather landed at Ellis Island and. In 1901, and, you know, got off the boat and went, okay, let's figure this out. You know? Yeah, so that, you know, that whole Eastern European thing, you know, it's like there's something there. There's some crazy stuff going on musically from that standpoint. But on the other hand, I it's sort of like, you know, it's like what you hear gets all jumbled up and comes rolling out at the craziest times and in the most unusual ways. And I think that's part of the creativity part that people go, well, what were you thinking? Well, I'm not a damn thing. I wasn't thinking nothing. I was just humming or playing or listening to this set of changes. Wow, isn't that weird, you know? So the main thing with me is, you know, who are your influences? Well, let me give you an hour. You know, I'll tell you, you know, 137,000 names of musicians and composers that, you know, it's like there's no bad music and none of it's bad. You know, I mean, I'm okay. I may not be a huge fan of polka music or a huge fan of this or that, but I've never heard any of it that was bad. I just heard some of it that was badly performed. But, you know, look, there's
our station does have a Friday evening one-hour polka show, by the way.
You know what? I actually. not to backpedal, but the truth is, I've heard savage polka music that was really strong. You know, and the way I look at it, one of the most beautiful things about this thing that, you know, I've spent my life doing is there's only 12 of these. The 13th one's the same as the first. It's called an octave. And I don't give a damn who you are or where you're from or what you look like or what color your skin is or who you sleep with or who you vote for or any, none of that stuff matters. When the red light goes on and they go, hey, we're going to play, all the talking stops and the music starts. And everybody knows, everybody in the band knows, like, okay, this is really good or this isn't so good. And so you can talk a good game and you can have all the right jewelry on, the right clothes on. You can pull up in a limo or you can walk there with holes in your shoes. When it comes time to play, it comes time to play. And then all the baloney stops. And so to me, that one of the beautiful things about this is, you know, every year I go to Jazz Fest, inevitably I make my way to the gospel tent and I sit down and people come out there to play that might have been part of the maid service that made up my room in a nice hotel that I stayed in, or was driving the garbage truck that picked up the garbage at 4 a.m, or some little kid that's 15 years old, 14 years old, sits down and starts doing something. And none of these people are getting paid. And they ain't on MTV, and they're not on a radio, and they're not doing what I do. You know, they're just musicians. They're just playing, and they're not even making any money at it. They're just playing for the spirit of it, for the spirituality of it. You know, the connection to God for them with the music. And I'm going, oh my God, I'm supposed to know everything about this, and I don't. I can't even talk. I'm so thrilled by what's coming out of these people. The same thing happens to me in Dublin. I walk down the street, I see people with open cases, you know, blasting away, and I'm going, what is this? everybody in this place can play. You know, it's like the same thing in Memphis. You know, it's like, you just, what the hell is this? You know, these guys can all just kill it, you know, and I've spent my life studying this, and you can't play me any kind of music that I don't intellectually kind of understand. I mean, I can figure it out, you know. However, I don't know why it does what it does. It still kills me. And it's the simplest thing. I hear it again, and I go, oh my God, it's just so beautiful. How in the world does that happen? You know, it's like, oh, this is magic. Magic.
Who are the musicians then, and how did you pick who you used for these two recordings?
Okay, I'm so glad you asked me that, because it gets me a chance to talk about the real geniuses here.
I recognize a couple names.
Yeah, well, first of all, okay, so I'm 18 years of age. I'm a folky. I'm at the Troubadour, you know, on Hoot Night, you know, that David Crosby ran and all the rest. And I got a band, or a group called the Wellenbrook Singers, and I hear this bluegrass band follows us on or precedes us, and I hear this banjo player and a group called the Pine Valley Boys, and I go right up to this guy right after. I go, hey, man, you play great. You are fantastic. We got to know each other. And so we become best friends. Name's Herb Peterson. And, you know, find me somebody better at his job than Herb, and I'll kiss your rear end, you know. So Herb's just great. I produced a couple albums on him on Epic in the 70s. He's just a monster as a singer and a group singer, background singer. He's a monster as a guitar player, and he is world renowned as a banjo player. He's just fantastic. So he was the first phone call when I got this idea. Years ago, he had introduced me to this young kid that was going to SC as a guitar player, named Gabe Witcher. And Herb introduced him to me as a fiddle player. And I would go, whoa, this kid is a savage, you know? So, I came to know Patrick Salver as a guitar player, but I really hadn't heard him play mandolin. And Herb said, no, he's a great mandolin player. So he played both guitar and mandolin on that piece. And then Gabe led me to his brother, Mike Witcher, who is the dobro player. And just, wow. I mean, just wow. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's how this bluegrass ensemble came together. In terms of the blues piece, you know, I was hoping to, this is just almost, I don't even know how to put this, but I was hoping to have the rhythm section with people whose ancestors came from Africa. That's what I was hoping for, only because I just didn't want to be the white guy in the room that goes, okay, let's play the blues, boys. You know, I mean, it's just, you know, there's just a thing there, you know, it's like, well, wait a second, did we steal a bunch of music from a bunch of people that we enslaved, you know, all those years, or how did this happen, you know? And the truth is, there's a lot of different opinions about that. And, you know, the Black experience in America is so fraught with terror and unfairness and unpaid, you know, markers and bills, you know, and I'm not going to be able to straighten any of that out. I'm not smart enough, or I just don't know how to deal with any of that, you know, except to not deal with it, really, and be the best person I can be. So I had this kind of this goal. I was saying, well, at least I'll, you know, I certainly have enough close friends whose ancestors came from Africa that are great musicians. So the first call was to Abe Jr., you know, and I go, hey, would you be interested in doing this? And hell yes, I'm in. I go, great. Who are we going to get as a bass player? And he starts laughing, you know, because his old man and I have known each other forever. So I called Senior. I said, well, your kid's in. You want to do this thing? You know, and he said, hell yeah, I'm in. So, you know, and I had this friend named Robert Turner, who's a legitimate double-fisted genius piano player, you know, mainly gospel background, but he can play everything, you know. So Robert, you want to play? Yeah, I'm in, you know. So I hadn't really heard Eric Gales yet, and then my agent Mike Gorfain said, have you heard Eric Gales? I said, no. And I start researching Upside Down and Backwards, and I'm going, oh listen to that vibrato. What the hell? Who the hell is that? You know, so I got a hold of him and I said, and he goes, what is it? What? Hey man, I don't read. I said, don't worry about it. I do. And I got you. I'll get you through all this crap. And I kept looking around for the right slide player. And unfortunately, or fortunately, I have this dear friend, played at my wedding 30 years ago, blah, 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 named Sonny Landreth. And he happens to be, in my opinion, the greatest slide player in a tuning in the world, bar none. I've never heard anybody I thought was better than that. Now, certainly, you know, Derek Trucks is phenomenal. Certainly, he's phenomenal. So that's the distinction of in a tuning, okay, because Derek plays conventional tuning most of the time. But Sonny's my friend, and he's a genius. He is Yo-Yo Ma, the slide guitar, in my opinion. You know, when you put all those guys together, you know, even though it was done during COVID and we couldn't all play at the same time and the same thing together, we, you know, technologically, if the feel is the utmost, you know, guide, you know, the guiding light, the technology doesn't work you work it. And, you know, I don't care about quanting anything. I just care about it feeling right and feeling good. So
I would kick myself if I couldn't ask you, there's two specific questions. One is that a very close friend of mine who comes on the show quite a bit, he has a crazy mind for just film knowledge and history, and he's a soundtrack geek as well. He was very excited that you are coming on. But he also has a Blu-ray label, you know. He just has this mind and finds all these old movies that he loved as a kid or just recently discovered. A lot of them even like made for TV movies. It's called Fun City Editions. And his one of his next releases is Handgun, which I guess is an actual film that you did that's not a made for TV film or a TV series or anything.
Yeah.
Did you intentionally not do film, or just all the opportunities were hitting you in TV?
No.
You have a preference?
Yeah, I do. You know, I love the immediacy of television. All of my film composer friends, you know, at one time or another will call me up and go, now, why am I doing this? Why is this guy beating the living crap out of me? You know, so as you know, films are a director's medium. They run the whole thing. Whereas television is a writer producer's medium. You know, the directors are kind of not permanent party. They come and go. Look, every piece of music that I write for television has a few prerequisites. Number one, I got to like it. Number two, they got to love it. They got to think this is only way the music could have gone, right? Number three, and not most important, but very important, is it's going on the air at 9 o'clock, dude. Let's go. We cannot screw around here. We got to go. This is going on the air at 9. You know, there's an immediacy to it, and it makes it so that, you know, you don't get second guessed near as much as a composer as you do in the film business. So number one, the door that opened up was television because of Steve Cannell and then Stephen Botchko and then Dick Wolf. Well, let's see, if you just worked for three guys your whole career and they were Stephen Botchko and Stephen Cannell and Dick Wolf, would you be okay? Because I'm sure okay having just worked for those three maniacs. And so, you know, that's what opened up to me. Now, a few features opened up to me, but it just wasn't in the cards. It just didn't, you know, Handgun, I got replaced, you know, I got my score got thrown out. And I went down in flames in that thing, and it was political. Yeah. But so what, you know, that's just the way it happened.
It happens to the best of them.
Yeah. Everybody gets, Jerry Goldsmith got dumped, you know, I mean,
and you're Marconi.
That's exactly right. You know, I think Big John didn't get dumped, but he didn't get chosen to do a couple along the way, even though he invented them, you know, and you know, it's like the subsequent Star Wars one. And, you know, he's got the best attitude was, it's okay. Let them have whoever they want. Let them do whatever they want. It's okay. We're just in the band, you know.
Is your music for that available anywhere? Is that?
I don't know. I have.
It exists somewhere, but.
There's one film I did that I'm proud of. I'm not proud of the dub. I didn't get a very good end result on the dub. I think think they did a bad job, but I liked what I did. It was a movie called Running Brave with Robbie Benson, and it was pretty good. It was neat, fun to do.
Nice. Yeah. How did Van Halen 3 come about in the late 90s? You produced that, right?
I did.
Are you a friend of Eddie Van Halen's, or did you meet at that time?
I was a very dear friend of Eddie Van Halen's, and he was a dear friend of mine. It's a long story, You and I could, by the way, you and I are like two mirrors. We're down the same rabbit hole. Don't feel like you're all alone in this absurdity.
Good to know.
You have brothers out here in the world, okay? So I met Ed, and he came up to me, and he was very complimentary, and I didn't know who he was. So he said, well, you and I met a long time ago. You know, I was in Studio B with my band, and you were in Studio 8, United. And I'm like, I'm sorry, I don't remember meeting you. And I said, do you still have the band? And he said, yeah. I said, what's it called? And he goes, oh, Van Halen. And I said, okay, I'm not even going to speak to you. He goes, pardon me? I said, I'm not speaking to you. Get away from me. And he goes, what did I do wrong? I said, buddy, I know everything about this six-string instrument. My whole life. I said, and then Larry Carlton called me to come up to his house because he'd heard something he didn't understand. I went up to the house and he went, brr-ding. And I went, whoa, what'd you just do? He went, brr-ding, ticker, 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 ticker. I went, okay, what is that? And he said, there's some little kid in Pasadena. I heard at a club doing this with his brother playing drums. He said, I've never seen anything like it. I said, wait a second, you're moving the nut. He goes, exactly. And I went, oh my God. I said, so Eddie, you know, you reinvented an instrument I thought I understood pretty well. And, you know, and you come up to me and tell me you really like my music and you're, I said, just get away from me, you know. So we became really good friends and started hanging out. And so he came to me and said, hey, listen, I need your help. I said, what do you want to do? What? And he said, yeah. He said, I want to do an album sober. I said, well, yeah, I'm the right guy to help you with that. You know, because I'm not a drug guy. I never did any drugs. And I drank very little, you know, and never had a problem. He said, yeah, I just want you to help me. And I did. And really, I didn't so much produce the album as I did everything I could to let Eddie express himself the way he wanted to at the time. And Gary Cherone's a hell of a guy and a really good singer. But, you know, that album was a weird album, and it wasn't real good, to be honest with you. But it was what Ed wanted to do, and I did a good thing for Eddie. And, you know, I'm sorry he passed away.
I assume he was a big fan of a lot of your work. And
I think
over the years, you guys paid attention to each other's work. And
oh, yeah. I think he was, and I think the more than that, he, you know, he related to me because we both had the same kind of heart. You know, we were both, you know, raised on the radio and raised on rock and all the rest of it. But he became a superstar, you know, and I became, you know, I wouldn't say, you know, I had a straighter life. I just had a life that wasn't out there in stadium rock and didn't have all the craziness attached to it. But we're, you know, kind of the same guy, you know?
Yeah, and both great guitar players.
No. He was a great guitar player. Basically Mozart with a guitar in his hand. You know, I was pretty good for a little while until I became an arranger and a conductor and a composer. And then all my chops just, you know, just kind of, I'm okay in a studio and I can, you know, I can get through a little bit of something here and there. But, you know, man, the minute the pencil and the paper and the baton got into my hand, I took a hike as a guitar player.
And also the amazing track, the Mike Post theme, a Pete Townsend from his solo record.
That was an out-of-body experience. I mean, I just couldn't believe that this guy, you know, was write song about me or my music, you know. I mean, I just couldn't believe it. I went to the Greek Theater when they did that tour, right? And I sat in a box with my wife and my agent, Sam Schwartz, and Mike Gorfain, and their wives. And this guy gets up there and he goes, okay, I'm going to sing a song about a guy I never even met. And he said, but his music really means a lot to me. And so Pete sings a song, and I just sat there like, wow, this is a story of my life. As you know, some people know my music, maybe quite a few people know my music, but nobody knows me. What a great gig. You know, I mean, it's like I never get hassled. I never get bothered. And nobody asks for an autograph for nothing. It's just, what a wonderful life. All the good parts, none of the bad parts. You know what I mean?
Yeah. He was a Hill Street Blues fan. Is that?
I think it was NYPD connection? Blue. I think it was
NYPD Blue. Okay, yeah.
I went backstage to meet him, and there was a big long line. And I had a young kid at home with a babysitter, and I stood in the line for about 20 minutes, and then I told his assistant, "Hey, have him call me if he wants to go to lunch or something. But I gotta go. We got a kid at home," so we left.
You never got to meet him.
No, I never met him.
Oh, no. Yeah.
But it's cool. You know, it's
good. Yeah, one day it'll happen.
Whatever, you know, whatever.
It's an incredible song.
Yeah.
It, as a soundtrack, you know, fan or listener, geek or whatever, it doesn't even seem real. Like, wait, did I read that correctly? Mike Post's Theme by Pete Townsend.
Yeah.
You know, it's a strange title for any song, you know, let alone.
It's sort of. You look up incongruity in the, you know, there's that, you know, put that there. That doesn't have sense, does it?
Well, yeah. Are you still writing for TV?
Yes.
Themes and stuff? You're still working. So there's stuff on the horizon and.
Oh, yeah. I assume. Every week I'm doing SVU, Special Victims Unit. Every week I'm doing Law and Order, the original. I just did a little baby show for a little short 3-episode sitcom for BBC that was so much fun, called Mammoth. And I mean, I'm 79, almost 80. But you know what? I don't feel old. You know,
yeah.
I still get to go. Hey, Dad, are you going to work? And not really. I'm going to play. You know, I mean, that's,
well, yeah. I'm as excited just to see that you're still sending out or putting out into the world a solo record. You know, that has nothing to do with your day job.
Yeah.
And you appear to be as busy as ever. And your music just continues to grow. And these shows come, some of them that got canceled or were put on hiatus or whatever, they're coming back, I know. And your music's just going to continue and continue to flourish, you know. And it's great to see.
Thank you. I hope you're right. So far, historically, you're correct. This stuff goes away, it kind of just goes to China or someplace, I don't know.
yeah, I implore our listeners to go to mike-post.com. That's your website. A lot of info there. There's clips, you know, video clips of the new record coming out and, you know, actually conducting and orchestrating and things like that. And then a lot of your past work and reels and whatnot. So, but yeah, thanks so much for your time, and thanks for the new release.
Hey, I had a great time talking to you. You really know a lot about the work, and I really appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Oh, are you going to perform it any? Any chance up in L.A.?
I don't know. If somebody wants me to do it, I will.
Yeah, okay. I'll be on the lookout for that, too. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Take care.